Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Doctrine of Christ, Part 23. For more resources, including articles, books, podcasts, audio, and video, go to reasonablefaith.org.
We've been talking in the last several weeks about the resurrection of Jesus as the completion of the work of Christ. The work of Christ consists, on the one hand, of the cross, his substitutionary atonement, and then also of his resurrection from the dead. And we looked at all of the various ways in history that skeptics have tried to account for the resurrection and found them deficient. And so we then finally turned to a discussion of the original interpretation of the resurrection, namely the literal interpretation, and examined the problems that a literal interpretation of the resurrection of Jesus faces. And the main problem was the problem of miracles, namely, is it rational to believe in events which are beyond the power of nature to produce, like a resurrection from the dead? And I argued last time that the old argument that extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence really doesn't hold water, that this violates the probability calculus that probability theorists have developed, and that in fact there's really no reason to think that the resurrection hypothesis is improbable. And then we finally looked last time at the so-called problem of dwindling probabilities. That is to say, as your hypothesis becomes more refined, more specific, it becomes less probable on that original body of evidence. And we saw that this problem is to be overcome by augmenting the evidence as you make your hypothesis more specific, so that the evidence that is relevant, say, to the broad hypothesis that God exists will just be evidence, say, about the beginning of the universe or the design in the universe or the existence of moral values. But it won't include anything about the historical Jesus. But then as you begin to talk not just about God existing, but about the Christian God existing, and about Jesus and his radical claims and his resurrection, you pile up more evidence as the hypothesis becomes specific, and as a result, the probabilities do not dwindle. In fact, in the end, the probability of your Christian hypothesis, given all the evidence, may be actually higher than the probability of just, say, God's existence given general information in the world. But then I closed by saying that, in fact, I don't think this is how we ought to do an apologetic for the resurrection of Jesus. That, in fact, the probability calculus, as interesting as it is, really isn't very applicable in this area. And that's what I want to talk about today. You see, historians, when they test for historical hypotheses, don't really use the probability calculus. You won't find, I think, any history book that you would pick up that would talk about any secular events in history that would begin to plug in the values to these various elements in the probability calculus to try to figure out what is the best explanation of the evidence for the past. Why not? Well, I think that part of the reason is, the main reason is, that these probabilities are often inscrutable. That is to say, you just can't put any kind of numerical value to them. And therefore, you really can't use the probability calculus to any sort of degree of helpfulness in estimating the probability that some event occurred in the past. Now, in particular, take the resurrection hypothesis. And I think here we confront an immediate problem. What is the probability of the resurrection hypothesis on the background information alone? You remember, that was one of the elements in the probability calculus that you would have to assign a value to. Take your background information, represented here by B, which is just our general knowledge, apart from any specific evidence concerning Jesus' resurrection, just our background information of the world. What is the probability relative to that background information that God would raise Jesus of Nazareth from the dead? I don't think really we have any way of assigning any kind of value to that with any confidence. I think we can't say it's improbable because God's free to do what he wants. But how can we say that it is probable that he would do that? Maybe What would be more probable, given Jewish thinking, would be that God would wait until the end of history and then raise Jesus from the dead along with everybody else, and then everybody would see that he is God's son and would go into the kingdom of God and he would be vindicated. I mean, how do we know what God would do just given the background information? No evidence, you know, concerning the empty tomb or the appearances. And so it seems to me that this probability approach using the calculus isn't really that helpful in doing an apologetic for the resurrection of Jesus. And with that, most historians would agree, because historians don't use this. So how do historians arrive at the best explanation for things in the past? What criteria do they use? Well, I think that the model that can be used here is called inference to the best explanation. Inference to the best explanation. And by that, I'm talking about a technical term. Inference to the best explanation is a kind of reasoning in which you have a certain body of data to be explained, certain facts to be explained. And these, in the case of the resurrection, would include things like the crucifixion of Jesus, his burial by Joseph of Arimathea, the discovery of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances to different individuals and groups of people, the very origin of the Jesus movement itself. All of these would be various data to be explained. And then what the historian or the scientist does, this is really the same model of explanation, is he constructs a pool of live options for explaining this data. And these various live options in the pool of explanations will be his hypotheses. These will constitute hypotheses to try to explain the data. So, with respect to the resurrection, various live options would be things like the women went to the wrong tomb, or Jesus wasn't really dead, or the disciples had hallucinatory experiences after Jesus' crucifixion, or that this is all just mythology. Or one of them would be that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. That would be one of the live options for explaining the data. And then in order to determine or infer which is the best explanation, the inquirer, the scientist, or the historian will say, which one of these options, if true, would provide the best explanation of the data? So you're looking not for the only explanation. You're not saying there aren't any other live options. On the contrary, there are. But you're inferring to the best of these explanations. And you're saying, which explanation, if true, would best account for the data? Now, how do you determine what counts as a best explanation? What are the criteria going to be that you use to determine the best explanation? Well, in his book, Justifying Historical Descriptions, the historian, Bian McCullough, lists some of the criteria that historians use in assessing historical hypotheses. Bian McCullough is his name, and the name of his book is Justifying Historical Descriptions. Now, he's not a Christian. This is a secular historian in a book on historiography, about how you determine what are the best explanations for historical hypotheses. And let me just list what some of these criteria would be for the best explanation. One would be explanatory scope. Explanatory scope. Explanatory scope means that it will imply a greater variety of observable data. It will have a wide range of observable data that it will explain. Let's apply this to, say, the resurrection hypothesis. One of the weaknesses of the hallucination hypothesis is that it has narrow explanatory scope. The hallucination hypothesis is offered as an explanation of the postmortem appearances of Jesus, but it doesn't do anything to explain the empty tomb. So in order to account for the empty tomb, you've got to conjoin some independent hypothesis to the hallucination hypothesis to explain all the data. So that would be one of the shortcomings, say, of the hallucination hypothesis as an explanation of the data. It has narrow explanatory scope. It doesn't imply all of the facts, all of the data. Number two would be explanatory power. Explanatory power. This means that it makes the observable data more probable than it would have been otherwise. It has the power to explain the data. It makes the data more probable than it would have been otherwise. And so you want to pick the explanation which has the greatest degree of explanatory power. Let's pick on the hallucination hypothesis again, because I think this one also is wanting in explanatory power. How well does it explain the postmortem appearances of Jesus? Wholly apart from the empty tomb, how well does it explain what it purports to explain, those postmortem appearances? Well, not very well. For example, one of the things we saw was that if the disciples were to have hallucinated visions of Jesus, they would have projected visions of Jesus in glory, in Abraham's bosom, where the righteous dead went to await the resurrection at the end of the world. But in that case, hallucinations of Jesus in glory would never have led to belief in his resurrection. It would at best have led to belief in Jesus' assumption into heaven, that he had been assumed into heaven, but not that he was literally risen from the dead, which is a different category in Jewish thinking than assumption into heaven. So the explanatory power of the hallucination hypothesis it isn't very great, because it doesn't explain why the original disciples came to believe in and proclaim the resurrection of Jesus, which is one of those data to be explained, namely the origin of the belief in the resurrection. A third criterion would be plausibility. Plausibility. And here we're asking about the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the hypothesis. What is the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the hypothesis? And here, by accepted knowledge, we mean both the background evidence as well as the specific evidence in this case, the data that we have in this case, compared to the degree to which the data would imply the falsity of the hypothesis. So plausibility means you take all of your information, and what's the degree to which it implies the truth of the hypothesis as opposed to implying the falsehood of the hypothesis? Which one is more plausible, given the data, that the hypothesis is true or that it's false? Now, oh, thanks, Marion. Let's apply this again in the case of the resurrection. Take, for example, the wrong tomb theory, that the disciples or the women went to the wrong tomb and found a gardener there who says, oh, you're seeking Jesus of Nazareth. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, pointing to some other tomb, right? That was one of the theories for explaining the empty tomb. Is that very plausible? Well, not at all when you think about it, because if the women had made that mistake and they began to proclaim the resurrection of Jesus in Jerusalem, all the Jewish authorities would have had to do is just point to the right tomb. They must have been very amused when the disciples went around saying he's risen from the dead, when Joseph of Arimathea could say, well, no, here's where he's laying, and there's the corpse in the tomb. So you see, there's not much plausibility to that hypothesis. The data tend to imply its falsehood rather than its truth. Fourth would be the degree to which the hypothesis is what's called ad hoc. And you want a hypothesis which is less ad hoc. Now, what does ad hoc mean? Well, literally in Latin, it means to this, ad hoc, to this. And it means the degree to which the theory is sort of concocted just to explain this. It's contrived. There's a sort of artificiality about it that you wouldn't have good reason to believe otherwise. So if a theory is ad hoc, it means that there really isn't much independent reason to believe that it's true. Instead, you've got to invent all kinds of new hypotheses just to explain this evidence that you don't have any grounds to believe is true. Let me illustrate this with the twin theory. Do you remember that fellow I debated at the University of California, Irvine, who said that the best explanation for the resurrection was that Jesus of Nazareth had an unknown twin brother, that Jesus really wasn't born by Mary and Joseph. He and his twin brother were born to some other Jewish peasant lady, and that some way or another, he got switched with Mary and Joseph's baby, so that Mary and Joseph now thought that Jesus was their baby, when in fact he was the twin of somebody else born to some other Jewish woman, and his brother grew up independently from him in some other town in Judea, and just at the time of the crucifixion, his brother came back to Jerusalem, saw that Jesus was crucified, stole the body out of the tomb, and presented himself to the disciples, who mistakenly thought Jesus was risen from the dead. Now that is a theory which is ad hoc in excelsis, right? I mean, we don't have any reason to believe that Jesus had a twin brother. We don't have any reason to believe that he was switched with some other baby. We don't have any reason to believe this fella came back to Jerusalem, you know, just at this time. It is so ad hoc and contrived that it fails to be the best explanation. During the Q&A that I had with this at this debate, one person in the audience got up, and he kind of captured it nicely, this ad hocness. He said, Dr. Cavan, my opponent, he said, there's only one thing that remains unexplained on your theory. Who was piloting the helicopter at the time of the ascension? Well, that was just one more ad hoc hypothesis that needed to be added to complete the theory. Number five is that it needs to be disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs. Disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs. Now, what do we mean by that? To say it's disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs means that if you add the hypothesis to accepted truths, that fewer falsehoods will result. By adding our hypothesis to the body of accepted beliefs, you will have fewer falsehoods if it is disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs. So to apply this one of the theories of the resurrection, take the apparent death theory, that Jesus was taken down from the cross alive, placed in the tomb where he revived, and got out to convince the disciples he was risen from the dead. That is hugely disconfirmed by what we know about medical science and crucifixion. And I think Mike Lacona talked about that when he was here a few weeks ago, that studies of what happens to a person when you're crucified show that it is preposterous to think that Jesus could have been still alive when he was taken down from the cross, much less if he were alive, not to have died almost immediately from exposure in the tomb without extraordinary medical care and medical attention. So that apparent death theory is hugely disconfirmed by accepted beliefs. Now, I just might say here, but isn't the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead disconfirmed by accepted beliefs? Isn't that also disconfirmed, that dead men do not rise? Doesn't that disconfirm the hypothesis? I think not. Notice how the hypothesis is worded. The hypothesis is not that Jesus came back naturally from the dead. That is disconfirmed hugely by what medical science and biology tell us. The hypothesis is God raised Jesus from the dead. And that is not in any way disconfirmed by what medical science tells us about what would happen naturally to someone who is dead. It would be a miracle for somebody to come back from the dead. Well, that's exactly what this hypothesis is. It says that God raised Jesus from the dead, and that hypothesis is not disconfirmed by any accepted beliefs about what happens naturally to people after they're dead. So that would be, again, just this old problem of miracles again, that people who have a prejudice against miracles don't want to accept a supernatural explanation. And finally, the sixth criterion would be that it exceeds its rival hypotheses in meeting criteria 1 to 5. That there's little chance that future evidence or future discoveries will show that one of these other hypotheses turns out to meet the 5 criteria better than the accepted hypothesis. So in order to be the best explanation, it should exceed its rival hypotheses in meeting conditions 1 to 5 to a good degree. And what I've tried to do in my published work, as well as in my debates, is to show that the best explanation of the data with respect to Jesus' resurrection is the hypothesis God raised Jesus from the dead. And if you're interested in seeing these criteria applied in some detail, look at my book with Gerhard Ludemann called Jesus' Resurrection Fact or Figment. Jesus' Resurrection Fact or Figment, where Ludemann defends the hallucination hypothesis. And I take that hypothesis through each one of these 6 criteria. And in assessing rival live options, very often what you'll find is that one option will say meet some criteria better, but another option will meet other criteria better. So that one hypothesis, say, will have great explanatory power and explanatory scope, but it might be very ad hoc, or it might be more implausible. Where some other theory would be very plausible, but it would have narrow explanatory scope. But what I find in the case of the resurrection, at least with respect to the hallucination hypothesis, is that in every single one of these areas, the resurrection hypothesis far outstrips the hallucination hypothesis in terms of its scope, power, plausibility, degree of ad hocness, and so forth. So if you're interested in seeing these applied specifically to a rival hypothesis, look at the book Jesus' Resurrection Fact or Figment. So, in conclusion then, I think this is the way a successful apologetic for Jesus' resurrection should be structured. As interesting as the probability calculus is, the fact is that some of those probabilities are probably inscrutable for us today. But that's not how historians work anyway. The way historians work is by inference to the best explanation. You have a pool of live options to explain a body of data which has been established. So what the Christian apologist does is he establishes a body of data that need to be explained concerning the fate of Jesus of Nazareth. And these will include things like the discovery of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, the very origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. Then you will assess the various hypotheses for explaining that data in terms of these criteria. And the theory which provides the best explanation is going to be then the preferred theory, and will be the theory that you ought to accept and regard as true. And the Christian apologist will maintain that that will be the resurrection hypothesis. All right, any questions then about how that sort of apologetic works? Cindy? Yes, Cindy asked about, would this be similar to historical sciences like the theory of evolution? Or you could also say geology or paleontology, which are also historical sciences. And my answer would be yes. For example, one of the arguments that one will hear about against creationism is that it doesn't have explanatory scope. For example, there are facts concerning what scientists call biogeography, which are very interesting. For example, why is it that all of the marsupials tend to be found in Australia? Marsupials are mammals that bear their infants in a pouch, like an opossum or kangaroo, of course. Yeah, kangaroo. I was trying to think of other examples. And one could say the creationists could say, well, God just chose to create all the marsupials in Australia. That was just his choice, and he didn't want to do it anywhere else. But the evolutionist will say, it's much more plausible that all of these marsupials are interrelated, that they're all descended from one common ancestor, and being isolated on that continent, that's why they're all there. Now, of course, then he has to deal with possums, right, which are North American marsupials. That's not true that they're all confined to Australia. There are marsupials elsewhere. But nevertheless, that's just an application of the criteria that I'm talking about. That would be an illustration of where someone would indict the theory by saying its scope is too narrow. By contrast, on the other hand, creationists and intelligent design theorists are constantly blasting Darwinism because of its weak explanatory power, that the mechanisms of genetic mutation and natural selection don't have the power to explain the degree of biological complexity we have to do today. So these are exactly the kind of criteria that would be applied in those kinds of debates. Yes, Brad. Yeah, that's right. When you're dealing with agents, you've got that additional problem that you're not dealing with random processes, but with things like natural selection and mutation, there you are talking about purely non-intelligent, non-directed processes that would be more amenable to a probability type approach, if that could be done. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes, David. Boy, yeah. Let me see if there's someone else, Cindy, who has a question before I call on the same person again. Some other question. Yes, Carl. Right. Okay, what Carl raises is the important issue that we talked about, I think, when we spoke about the ID movement when we had our Q&A period the other day. And that is, what goes into the pool of live options? You see, you can't consider every hypothesis. That would just be uncontrollable. And so everybody has to limit the pool to live options. So, for example, no historian, despite what you hear in the sensational press, no historian takes seriously the idea that, say, Jesus was an alien from outer space, you know, who had come down from a UFO and learned the Hebrew language so that he could, you know, convince people to follow him or something, you know, chariots of the gods kind of thing. Nobody takes seriously something like that. It's not a live option. And as Carl said, determined naturalists will say that any kind of supernatural explanation here is excluded from the pool of live options. And of course, that's Philip Johnson's point about evolutionary theory, is that if you make the live options only naturalistic options, he says, yeah, I think Darwinism is the best explanation. I would infer to Darwinism too. But he says, why exclude supernatural explanations? Well, here, Carl, now you see we're going to demand a rationale for excluding it. And what you'll find is it will typically come back to the problem of miracles that we've just been talking about for the past few weeks, or maybe even the question of theism. You see, if God exists, this will raise the probability of a supernatural explanation. And so in one sense, maybe one will need to retreat all the way back to the question of, well, is there a God? And then go through the arguments of natural theology that we talked about probably last year in this class on why do we think there are good reasons to believe that God exists. Otherwise, the exclusion of supernaturalistic hypotheses from the pool of live options becomes arbitrary. You need to have some rationale for excluding it. Jay? Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Did you hear Jay's remark? N.T. Wright says to the skeptic, you have to first recognize that your problem with miracles is not a historical problem. It's not a question of the evidence. It's a philosophical problem. And when you're ready to discuss it on that level, then we can. And I say, yeah, let's do it. Okay. Some other question, Mary? Yeah, that's a good point. I think there are arguments for the existence of God that don't appeal to intelligent design. For example, there are versions of the cosmological argument that asks philosophical questions like, why is there anything at all, rather than just nothing? Why does anything exist? And you could argue that the best explanation is that there's a necessary being who exists. Or the moral argument, from moral facts, that we sense the existence of objective moral values and duties in the world, and those could not exist without God. Therefore, that gives good reason to believe that God exists as a locus, a source of moral values. So there are non-intelligent design type arguments. If you're interested in looking at those, take a look at J.P. Moreland and my book called Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview, which has two chapters in it on arguments for God's existence. But if the person, again, is not even going to allow you to give arguments for God's existence because of his naturalism, then he's simply presupposing atheism to be true. He's begging the question. So it's not him that's reasoning, or it's not you that's reasoning in a circle, it's him. He's reasoning in a circle in presupposing atheism in order to preclude theism. And you've got to say, if we're going to talk about this, we have to do so with an open mind. All right, one more question and then we'll close. Yes, Jim. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. I'm an open-minded inquirer myself about these things. And I find the facts of biogeography to be interesting and disturbing, and I don't know. It's something I've not looked into. So don't take my ignorance here as indicative of the fact there's not a good answer. Rather, take it as the fact that this isn't my area of specialization, and so I've never explored it. I've just heard this raised in debates. I've never looked into it because it's just not on the front burner for me, and so I don't know the answer. I do know there are marsupials that don't live in Australia. You know, we had one on our back porch some time ago. So I don't know. I don't know. But I'm just saying here is that any good creationist theory of origins is going to need to address those facts, and we'll need to have some explanation. And so I'm leaving that up to my colleagues like Paul Nelson and Michael Behe and Doug Axe and others to work on that area, because that's an area I'm not working on. All right, well, okay, Cindy.
I just want to add.
Absolutely. Yes. Cindy's point is that they may see that given this data, the resurrection hypothesis is the best option. So they're going to go back and deny the data.
Right.
They'll say Jesus never existed, or the tomb is a legend, or they never had experience of seeing Jesus alive from the dead. And you're absolutely right about that, Cindy. People like John Dominic Crossan, Gerrit Ludemann, and so forth, deny the fact of the empty tomb, because once you grant the empty tomb, you're in trouble. So they deny the data. But, and here's the thing that I find so intriguing, is that the majority of New Testament historians today accept this data. They accept the historicity of the empty tomb. You saw it in the 2020 show, those Jewish scholars that were interviewed. Yeah, the tomb probably was found empty. So it is the skeptic here who is on the defensive, not the Christian. The data is largely accepted by New Testament historians today, and so we stand comfortably within the mainstream. And the question then is, what is the best explanation?
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.